Your headlines for this hour: Israeli forces once again stormed the Nasser hospital in southern Gaza as the regime's unrelenting airstrikes claim more civilian lives elsewhere across the territory. The head of UNRWA says the situation in Gaza has limited the agency's ability to implement its mandate and pushed it to breaking point. A Yemen's Ansarullah leader vows intensified operations against Israel-linked vessels as the country's army announces attacks on Israel, US destroyer and a UK ship. Thank you for joining us. Now, there is apparently no end in sight to Israel's thirst for blood in its onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime's latest strikes on several residential buildings in central Gaza have killed at least 40 people, leaving over 100 others injured. The city of Deir al-Balah and the town of Zawaida were the latest targets of the regime's air raids. Israeli attacks killed nearly 100 people in the past day alone. The regime has also launched a series of deadly airstrikes on the southern city of Rafah, where some 1.4 million Palestinians have taken refuge. Gaza's health ministry says Israeli troops have once again stormed the Nasser Medical Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis after a brief withdrawal. It is Gaza's second largest hospital. Israeli forces have surrounded the facility, preventing the entry or exit of medical personnel and civilians. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says it has managed to evacuate 51 patients from the hospital, but 140 others are still stranded there.
WHO so far conducted three high-risk missions into Nasser Hospital and managed to evacuate 51 patients to the hospitals in the south, but we still have around 140 patients remaining in the hospital. Those figures unfortunately change on every hour basis because of the hostilities. Some patients leave themselves. A lot of patients remain in the hospital, but some patients also unfortunately succumb to the wounds that because they went to the hospital.
He's a ventilator.
The World Body said it will try to evacuate critically ill and critically wounded patients from the Nasser Hospital to other hospitals in the south, including the field hospitals that have been established in Rafah. Over the past 4 months, Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has killed nearly 30,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, leaving about 70,000 others injured. Now, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says the current situation in Gaza has limited UNRWA's ability to implement its mandate and pushed it to a breaking point. Felipe Lazzarini made the remark in a letter to the President of the General Assembly. He said, due to Israel's repeated calls to dismantle UNRWA and the freezing of funding by donors, the agency's ability to continue its operations has been seriously threatened. Lazzarini noted that in just over 4 months in Gaza, there have been more children, more journalists, more medical personnel and more UN staff killed than anywhere in the world during a conflict. He said over 150 UNRWA premises have been hit by Israeli bombardment or shelling, killing and injuring hundreds of people. During the past months, Israel has been pushing to have UNRWA dismantled. The regime claims that some of the agency's staff were involved in the operation carried out early last October in the occupied territories by the Gaza-based resistance groups. The UN agency has emphatically rejected Israel's allegations. Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Nasser Mashni, president of the Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network. Mr. Mashni, let's begin with your thoughts on what the UNRWA chief says about the Palestinian Refugee Agency, saying that it's near its breaking point. From what we've seen, the regime has basically targeted anything in its path, from hospitals and medical facilities to UN-run schools and shelters. And it seems that that wasn't enough, so the regime found an excuse to end the aid assistance by several donor countries. And this has happened when the world is calling for aid for the civilians in Gaza.
Firstly, thank you so very much for having me on, Zaha. The reality is what we're seeing is what Palestinians have known all along. This is not a war on Hamas. It's not a war on Gaza. This is a war on Palestinians. Whether it's the death toll and the injury toll, whether, as you said before, the destruction of every piece of civilian infrastructure, from hospitals and roads, schools, mosques, churches, even the third oldest church on earth. This is a war, a genocidal war on Palestinians, on the right of Palestinians to live in their ancestral homes, and is an extension of the racist, Zionist, settler colonialist agenda and regime.
Mr. Mashin, as you said, Israel has yet to provide evidence to prove that allegations, prove the allegations that a dozen UNRWA employees out of, I think, around 13,000 working in Gaza took part in the October 7 operation on Israel. Now, the Israeli dossier that is the basis for the allegations hasn't proved any evidence for its claims. So how come these Western allies, these Western countries were so quick to stop the funding when there has been no proof? And even if there was, why does a whole organization and the people it's trying to help, we're talking about millions of people, more than like around 2 million people now in need, have to suffer for that?
Well, I think you've hit it on the nail on the head, Zara. This is an attack on UNRWA, as it is an attack on Palestine. The fact is, we know that Israeli Hasbara propaganda, Israeli lies, continue to be disproved. They are disproved from the foundational documentation that suggested that this was a land without people, for a people without a land, that allowed for the Zionist project to be initiated, all through every lie they have perpetuated. And at October 7, about beheaded babies, about rapes, about children being put into ovens. And it can extend itself back to so many. In 2021, the bombing of the tower in Gaza that was the communications tower, to the Qana massacre in Lebanon, to Mohammed al-Dura crouched behind his father in images many of us remember against the wall as he was being covered and sheltered by his father and he was assassinated, to the four Abu Bakr brothers and cousins that were running across the beach in 2006 and hit with an Israeli gunship. It was Hind, six-year-old Hind, sitting in a car calling and saying, "Everybody's dead, please come and save me," for 2 hours. The Red Crescent coordinating with the Israelis to allow for the safe passage of an ambulance, and then the killing. They used Hind as bait. They used a six-year-old girl as bait to get two Palestinians in to kill more people. The lies of the Israeli Zionist regime know no ends, and it's about the destruction of UNRWA and UNRWA's mandate, which is to look after Palestinian refugees. What they want to do is have all of the Palestinian geography with none of the Palestinian demography. This is about making Gaza uninhabitable, and it will take a decade to rebuild. And where will those Palestinians be? Probably not in Gaza. And will anybody return to Gaza when it is, if it is, rebuilt?
Mr. Mashin, just before we let you go, do you think the Israeli regime deliberately targets these UN-run facilities, especially the dismantling of UNRWA, not forgetting hundreds of doctors and medical staff have also been killed during the onslaught by the regime? And how can they get away with it?
Well, it's part of empire in the first instance. Number one, we know that it's deliberate targeting because we've seen overnight what they did in Syria with a targeted Hellfire missile. They took out a single apartment in Syria. They've done that in Lebanon. In the past, in their operations, they have been quote-unquote surgical. What they are doing now is dropping 2,000-ton bombs, the equivalent TNT of three Hiroshima nuclear bombs have been dropped on a piece of dirt only 365 square kilometers in size. This is beyond war. This is a genocide, as the International Court of Justice has said. And Israel is an outpost of Western imperialism, of Western hegemony, which is why the West is complicit in Israeli crimes. It's complicit in the genocide. It has allowed for both the diplomatic coverage and the mainstream media narrative that allows for these horrific crimes to be perpetuated in the world's names. Gaza 23 is a seminal moment. The global South will never forget the hypocrisy of the West when it didn't care about brown children the way it cared about white children in Ukraine.
Mr. Mashin, thank you for your time. Sir, I know you were short on time, so thank you for making it. There you have it, Mr. Nasser Mashni, President of Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network. Thank you, sir. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, a number of UN experts have sounded the alarm about the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the war-ravaged territory. The expert noted that the people of Gaza have lost access to suitable medical services amid Israel's incessant attacks on the health sector. They said many surgeries, including on pregnant women who need cesarean section and children needing amputations, are carried out without anesthesia. The experts urged the Israeli regime to implement an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and avoid any measures that would increase civilian casualties. They added that Gaza needs more shelters and schools as its educational facilities are no longer operational. Now, addressing the UN Security Council, the head of the medical organization Doctors Without Borders speaks of the humanitarian group's frustration and desperation in the face of the relentless Israeli attacks on Palestinians across the besieged Gaza Strip.
For 138 days, we have done everything we can to enact a meaningful humanitarian response. For 138 days, we have watched the systematic obliteration of a health system we have supported for decades. We have watched our patients and our colleagues be killed and maimed. This situation is the culmination of a war Israel is waging on the entire population of the Gaza Strip, a war of collective punishment, a war without rules, a war at all costs. The laws and the principles we collectively depend on to enable humanitarian assistance are now eroded to the point of becoming meaningless. Madam President, the humanitarian response in Gaza today is an illusion. A convenient illusion that perpetuates a narrative that this war is being waged in line with international laws. Calls for humanitarian assistance have echoed across this chamber. Yet in Gaza, we have less and less every day. Less space, less medicine, less food, less water, less safety. We no longer speak of a humanitarian scale-up. We speak of how to survive even without the bare minimum. Today in Gaza, efforts to provide assistance are haphazard, opportunistic, and entirely inadequate.
A Palestinian man has been killed and over a dozen others wounded in an Israeli airstrike on a car in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry said one of those injured is in critical condition. According to local sources, the man killed in the attack was Yasser Hanoun, who had served time in an Israeli jail. The attack came a day after clashes between Palestinian fighters and Israeli troops erupted in Jenin. Israeli forces have repeatedly targeted the city of Jenin and its refugee camp since the outbreak of the regime's onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Over 400 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers across the West Bank since then. The top UN court has held its fourth day of hearings on Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian territories. Our correspondent in The Hague, Max Civili, has a report.
On Thursday, the International Court of Justice held its fourth day of hearings on the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories since 1967. The case was prompted by the UN General Assembly in December 2022, when the international organization passed a resolution requesting an advisory opinion from the ICJ on Israel's policies and practices in the West Bank and in East Al-Quds, with a focus on the legal consequences arising from depriving the Palestinians from self-determination. 52 nations and three organizations, namely the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the Arab League and African Union, are taking part in the hearings.
Well, I think what we are witnessing today is a public trial. Country after country is exposing the evilness of occupation, is showing the tremendous violation of human rights that occupation continues to commit day in and day out, and it's also addressing the inhumane barbaric war that Israel continues to bring upon Gaza.
Iran and China were among those countries addressing the ICJ hearing on Thursday.
The UNGA resolution 3070 of 1973, I quote, reaffirms the legitimacy of the people's struggle for liberation from colonial and foreign domination and alien subjugation by all available means, including armed struggle,
As our Supreme Leader said, the calamity of Gaza is the calamity of humanity and international community as a whole. Therefore, each and every state and relevant international organization has its own legal and moral responsibility to act urgently and decisively to prevent the ongoing crimes of the Israeli regime in Gaza Strip.
Outside the court, braving the Hague's cold temperature, tens of people from across the Netherlands held a demonstration in solidarity with Palestinians.
I personally believe that the fact that it's not legally binding doesn't matter. I don't think this court case is necessarily going to be the direct reason that the Palestinian people will be liberated. I think it will be the pressure on our governments and international community that will hopefully make justice prevail.
Millions of people across the world are watching this case at the International Court of Justice. They are hoping that their faith in an international law-based system can be finally restored after decades of Israel subjecting the Palestinians to discrimination, apartheid, and deadly military force, and evading accountability. Max Civili, The Hague.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says his country will intensify operations in the Red Sea.
And we will escalate also our operations in this regard as well. We have escalated in quality and in quantity. We have effectively used the rockets and the drones and even the vessels, the naval vessels as well. We have also entered submarines as well, which is something that has confused the enemy and also terrorized the enemy and also the sea. We have targeted 48 vessels in the Red Sea and the Arab Sea, and this is a very significant number.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the U.S. is not capable of intercepting newly developed Yemeni rockets and submarines. He said the U.S. and the U.K. have failed to limit Yemeni operations and are surprised of Sana'a's capabilities. Houthi reiterated that Sana'a will continue its military operations in the Red Sea until Israel stops its onslaught on Gaza and ends the siege on the Palestinian territory. The Yemeni leader also slammed Arab states and media for failing to support Palestinians. Houthi also slammed the Arab media for repeating US and British rhetoric against Yemen. He once again called on Yemeni people to mobilize for another rally in solidarity with Palestinians on Friday. Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
A Zionist entrepreneur who participated in the genocide in Gaza has pitched a so-called plan to a European firm for the territory's future. The pitch reveals an underlying desire to conquer and control every inch of Palestine, including Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, a Zionist entrepreneur who participated in the genocide in Gaza has pitched a so-called plan to a European firm for the territory's future. the Gaza Strip, which the plan assumes would be conquered and controlled by the Zionist regime, would be divided into two zones. In the northern zone, Palestinian collaborators would be permitted to live in relative comfort, while those who refuse to serve and obey their Zionist masters would be banished to a southern area of terror. The Electronic Intifada has seen a copy of this so-called day-after plan. The pitch exposes the frightening colonial mindset and racist view of Palestinians pervasive in Israel. It also reveals an underlying desire to conquer and control every inch of Palestine, including Gaza. The plan was submitted by Or Bokazba, a Zionist reserve officer in the Sayeret Matkal Elite Commando Unit, who was deployed in Gaza for several weeks during October and November. Bokazba lives in New York City but was in Israel on October 7th when the Palestinian resistance group Hamas led a military operation that destroyed the Zionist regime army's Gaza division, which is responsible for enforcing the Zionist regime's siege on the territory. Bokazba immediately reported for duty and was deployed to root out the Hamas fighters that day, according to a glowing profile in the Wall Street Journal. Bokazba, who spent 8 years in the Zionist regime's army for longer than the mandatory service requirement, has also participated in every war since 2005. He's also the chief executive of Venn, a company that makes software for large-scale residential landlords to manage, monitor, and extract maximum rents and revenue from tenants. It has received $100 million in venture capital, according to the Wall Street Journal. At least 15% of his employees also enlisted as reservists with the Zionist regime's military after the genocidal war on Gaza was declared. Another Zionist businessman, Iran Hagiag, is also named in the proposal. The Electronic Intifada learned Hagiag is a co-founder of Bokazba's company, Venn. Bokazba's proposal calls for the total destruction of northern Gaza and its reconstruction as a managed colony. Gaza, too, where Palestinians who behave according to the rules set by the Zionist regime will be allowed to stay. Those who misbehave will be expelled to a hellscape in southern Gaza, or, as he calls it, Gaza 1, the area of terror. The plan reads as a cross between Silicon Valley elevator pitch and the script for a science fiction horror movie. But to the extent it purports to be a real plan, it is not the first of its kind. In early 1990s, when the Oslo Accords were signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization, media hyped that Gaza would turn into a Singapore on the Mediterranean. Such notions were revived again after the child killer regime of Israel redeployed its occupation forces to the perimeter of Gaza in 2005 and then began imposing an ever-tightening siege. The condition behind these pie-in-the-sky promises, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, has always been that Palestinians surrender any hopes of self-determination and instead settle for economic crumbs, while the Zionist regime retains all real power over their lives. In the event, under the guise of peace process, the Zionist regime began to isolate Gaza and systematically de-develop its economy, as a scholar Sarah Roy describes. At the same time, it has accelerated its colonization of the West Bank, corralling Palestinians into ever-shrinking islands of land surrounded by a sea of Zionist settler colonies. Bokazba's vision is in this tradition, albeit with the nightmare softened by the cheerful language of a real estate broker and sprinkled with upbeat tech charlatanry. A week ago, I stood in Gaza watching the sunrise over a land destroyed by conflict, says his proposal submitted to the European firm in late November. Bakazba also claimed, Gaza is a truly beautiful place with incredible views, beaches, and full of potential. He says of the killing fields where thousands of dead Palestinians still lie under the rubble of their homes and in makeshift mass graves. He claimed, on October 7th, I put on my army uniform and in that moment I switched from being or the entrepreneur or the soldier, and I immediately started to think like a soldier again. You take orders and you execute. You can question the how, but not the why, not the big picture or the strategy. I realized that we all put on our army uniform on October 7th and started thinking like soldiers, especially our leaders, he claimed. While participating in the genocide and the bombing and shelling campaign, described to be among the deadliest and most destructive in recent history, Bakazba dreamed of what to do under ruins with the help of the US and certain Arab regimes in order to serve the Zionist regime's pipe dream of subduing Palestinian resistance once and for all. His plan would permanently partition northern and southern Gaza, respectively, into the area of hope and the area of terror. Bakazba hoped the Zionist regime would start implementing the so-called plan as soon as December 2023 and begin turning Gaza into the poster boy of hope for the Palestinian people. But that assumed that the Zionist regime would quickly defeat the Palestinian resistance and gain control of all or most of Gaza. That has not happened, however, as the resistance continues to inflict heavy losses on the Zionist regime's invaders in every part of Gaza. Meanwhile, according to the plan, the south will serve as a transition area for those awaiting relocation, an apparent endorsement of ethnic cleansing of those Palestinians who cannot prove their loyalty and utility to the Zionist regime. Residents of this imaginary plan would be recruited through inspiring brochures that we will drop in the millions from the sky, which will contain plan details and application procedures, he claimed. This plan does not explain how Palestinians displaced, starving, dying of thirst, living with untreated injuries, illnesses, and trauma, and cut off from communications, will submit their applications, or why they would even consider trusting the fabricated regime of Israel. Bakazba claims applicants will commit to not having any association with terror groups, and the residency will be revoked if they do. Bakazba describes a digital application process and a committee to determine who could live in the proposed Gaza 2 made up of Americans, Israelis, and Palestinian collaborators. He claimed, one mistake and you are out to the old Gaza without a way to come back for a few years. Bringing together all the mindsets common to a landlord, prison ward, and colonizer. Bakazba is not shy that his motivation is entirely the Zionist regime's benefit. He claimed, this is not altruism for the Palestinian people, adding that his so-called plan would be the biggest blow to resistance groups like Hamas. He calls for the Zionist regime government to begin implementing the project initially before turning it over to Palestinian collaborators under Israeli regime supervision, similar to the Palestinian Authority in the occupied West Bank. Bakazba also hopes that a plan marketed as helping Palestinians will result in changing sentiment toward the Zionist regime in the international community for the better. Headlines would, he hopes, turn to Israel brought a solution instead of Israel kills children. The fabricated regime of Israel has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza during its genocide. The United Nations has acknowledged that most victims are women and children. Bokhozba also markets his so-called plan as an effort to bring a success story, as he claimed, that will aid U.S. President Joe Biden's re-election campaign.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be your host in this program. And then we have Brother Mustafa with us to help us with the topics related to Muslim ladies. So, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam. Happy to be back for these episodes. You know,
thank you very much. Just for those people who have joined us recently, give us a very brief introduction about yourself.
Sure. I'm studying here in the Hawza, and I'm studying psychology as part of my studies. And I've been here for about 6 years.
Yeah. So, Brother Mustafa is an expert in psychology, and he knows about Islamic heritage and the narrations. So he's going to help us to look at Muslim ladies and their topics from the perspective of men.
I'll try my best, yes.
Yeah, thank you for your cooperation. And right now in today's episode, we're going to look at history, at how women were treated back in time when the Prophet started to emerge. So, and how he challenged those notions and fought them back.
Right. So historically, you know, speaking, we know that before the Prophet, we call that era I think everybody knows this, it's called the era of Jahiliyyah or ignorance.
And the Dark Ages.
The Dark Ages, because a lot of the practices that were being done back then, they were pretty bad, right? They didn't make a lot of sense many times. And fortunately, you know, women were treated extremely, extremely poorly back then. For example, they were treated as property of men. You know, they could just pretty much give them away, take them. We know, for example, that girls were buried alive at birth many times because they were seen as being sort of useless in terms of, you know, farming and like doing all of like the manly work, right? They couldn't go to war. So a lot of times the people back then, they viewed women really from a very weak point of view, that they were weak. And if a woman was born, they would bury them, right?
Yeah, they had a brutal perspective toward women.
Right. So from that point of view, I wanted to then sort of talk about how, you know, how the Prophet and the Quran came and challenged that, right? Yeah. One point I want to make is that if you think about it, the Prophet grew up in that same society, right? Like I'm almost 40 years old now, and the Prophet was almost 40. Well, he was 40 when he declared that he's a prophet, right? Now, imagine you're an Arab man living in that culture, you would think you would adopt the same practices, right?
Exactly.
Whereas the Prophet's sort of, or the Quran's views are completely going against that culture, right? And I would say they're so advanced or they're so progressive that we're still studying those things today. I mean, the Prophet didn't have a PhD. He didn't go to university, right? He didn't go and study elsewhere. So where was he getting these ideas from?
And what he said and what the Holy Book of Quran said about women and about everything are just timeless.
Right. I think that for me also proves how this religion is divine, that it's from God, that it is timeless, right? For me, that's one way to sort of prove the divinity and the miracle of the Quran, that it's challenging, like it's coming up with completely radical ideas which don't belong in that culture, mm-hmm. right? Which are just from somewhere outside.
Yeah. Right? So this is just the introduction. We go for a break and then we'll be back to see what's going on.
Sure.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Ladies, and we're talking about history and how women were looked upon back in time. And we're talking about the Prophet and how he challenged all those ideas and how brutal women were treated at the time when the Prophet came and started to talk about notions that were so unfamiliar for the people of those dark ages.
Right. So you can see from the get-go, if you read the Quran, you know, there are so many verses which talk about women, right, and their rights, and how, for example, they should be treated, what their role is in society. One thing I want to clarify before we really jump into it is this idea of, like, women being equal to men. I think that idea has to be sort of explained in the sense, and yes, in some cases, women are treated as equal to men. For example, in terms of, you know, worship and their spiritual ranking, for example, you know, their ability to, like, they're accountable just as men for their actions, right? In that terms, they're being treated equal. But then we also have to talk about equity, right? To give you an example, like, whoever talks about women being equal to men, then what about, let's say, in sports, right? Why do we have then separate sports for women and men, right? It's a very logical sort of, we know it's a logical.
Yeah, it's logical. It's pretty logical.
Then they have to be separated, right? In the same way, the Quran separates the roles and, you know, the rights of women and men based off of those sort of dimensions, right? So if somebody comes and says, you know, women and men are completely equal, that they have to be treated completely the same, yes, they have to be treated the same in terms of laws and, you know, accountability. But in terms of their roles in society, they can't be the same, just like how in sports and many other places, they're not the same, mm-hmm. right?
Well, actually, back in time, if we look back at history, we could see that the first time when they started to talk about the rights of women, they did not have this in mind to come and say, men and women are the same. They were just fighting for the rights of women. Like, right. Women have got rights. And in those ages, women had no rights. All they fought for were to have some of those rights.
Right. And the Prophet and the Quran have came and did that, right? They gave women their correct status. Like, the main, I would say, instead of using the words equal equality, we can say the word, you can use the word justice, right?
Yeah,
justice means
exactly.
Putting things in their own place, right? So the Prophet came in, not only did he give justice to the entire society, but of course he gave it to women specifically as well. Give you examples of that. If you look at the Quran, like some of the terms that are used, you know, from that you can tell, for example, mm-hmm. women are considered, you know, you'll see many verses where it talks about believing men and believing women, right? They're considered as Muslims. They're considered as servants of God. They have, like, shared prayers, fasting, you know, all of the things that that are applicable to any man, they're applicable to women as well in the Holy Quran. One other thing, you know, one of our teachers was, I've started attending this Dars Akhlaq, which is
the study of manners.
Study of manners and, you know, focus on spirituality. Yeah. So the person that was speaking that, he's an Ayatollah, and he was saying one of the problems that we have today, especially today, is we have problems in our thinking and our ideology. He said if people really refer to the Quran and you know, the lifestyle of the Prophet, they will realize that many of their, like, errors in thinking will go away.
Exactly.
So one example that he gave is that the focus of Islam is on purity and spirituality, which we've sort of lost today, right? You don't really see young youth, like focusing on, like, the spirituality. Right? They have just, like, 1,000 different questions, but they're not necessarily focusing on keeping themselves pure, for example, or keeping themselves spiritually strong, right?
Yeah.
Many people don't even believe that they have a spirit. Whereas the Quran says that, you know, we've created men and women from one soul, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in other religions, for example, they'll say like Eve was created from the rib of Adam, right? Hava was created from the rib.
Yeah.
We don't have that kind of concept. Or in Christianity, they say it was Eve, Hava, who was tempted by Satan in the Garden of Eden, right?
Yeah.
Whereas we don't believe that. We see that both were sort of tempted and they both exactly. did that. At the same time, they were both forgiven and they both asked for forgiveness. So you can see that equality in Islam started from the very beginning that we talk about Adam and Eve, right? They were both in the same status in heaven. And when they came down to earth, they were treated completely equally by God.
And also in the Holy Book of Quran, God says, "Inna akramakum 'inda Allah atqakum," that is, the most worthy of you in God's eyes are those who are more pious. And right. He does not mention whether it's a woman or a man.
Definitely. There's so many places where God doesn't mention whether it's a man or a woman, yeah. right? Like, for example, we have another verse where it talks about, you know, the word zawj, by the way, many times it's mistranslated into English. When you look at the Quran in English, many times they'll translate the word zawj as wife or wives, for example, whereas in reality it just means spouses.
Yeah.
Right? For example, we have a prayer where, you know, we ask God to give us spouses that are going to be, well, the exact verse is, رَبَّنَا حَبْلَنَا مِنْ أَزْوَاجِنَا وَذُرِّيَاتِنَا قُرَّةَ أَعْيُنٍ. Right?
Yeah.
Give us like children and spouses, which are going to be comfort for our eyes.
The happiness, yeah. They're going to be the happiness to our life.
You know, there's so many verses that we can really discuss. Like this prayer itself is such a beautiful prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
In another verse, for example, which is much more popular, I would say, where God says that, you know, we've created like this relationship between a man and a wife, where it brings them peace, right? It's for their own peace, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so we can keep it here, go for a break,
sure.
and then we come back to pursue the rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Brother Mustafa telling us about the historical challenges that have been there for the women and the things that Prophet changed in those dark ages.
Right. I think one of the things that the Prophet also brought is like very specific laws which protected women. For example, the law for, you know, false accusations against women, right? There's like Surah Nur, which talks in much detail about this, talks about the punishment for like, falsely accusing a woman, right? Or falsely accusing a man. Also, it works both ways, which I think would be very radical in that time, right? If you think about it, women were not given that much space to sort of practice law, right? Many times we have stories where women would come to the Prophet and say, you know, my husband did this, my husband did that.
Yeah.
And the Prophet would then, you know, judge or give, you know, judgments based off of that. For a woman to do that back then, I would say in that society where we talked about where it was the dark ages, you know, women were treated as property. How did he come up with that? How was he able to radicalize people's thinking to accept woman as an equal partner to a man?
Right? Yeah, which is very difficult.
That's very difficult. And then the Quran really defines, I think, the roles in society that a man and a woman have, right? For example, we're told that men are the caretakers of women, right? Women then are told, for example, are given responsibilities for childbearing and child weaning, right? So the Quran is very, very radical and revolutionary in that terms that these things that we're talking about, you know, I'm studying maybe in psychology about people have written books about these, you know, that they've spent their life studying these topics. Like if you go to the West, you know, you'll see that psychology has a history of like 200-300 years back, right?
Yeah.
And they're only really, women were only given rights in the West, for example, in the past 100 to 200 years. Whereas we're talking about 1,400 years in the middle of in an Arabian desert.
So what are the other laws or places that women have been brought into that before that they did not have a role in it?
It's a great question. There are so many places. You know, I mentioned one of those. One was like worship, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of role women played in worship back then, but we know that within Islam, the spirit is really, really important, right? Your spirituality. So in terms of worship, you know, women are given the same rank as men. Like, you could be a woman and you can be a much, like, you know, you can have a much higher spiritual rank than a man. It makes no difference. It depends on your actions. Other places we see, for example, in inheritance. When the father or husband dies, we see there are specific laws about how much inheritance, you know, woman will receive.
Yeah, and by the way Prophet respected his only daughter made it perfectly clear for everyone that women have got a place of respect.
You know, his first wife,
exactly,
Khadija, and then also the rest of his wives as well. Those are exemplary role models for us to see how the Prophet treated them. Yes. When he had problems
so,
with his wives.
Just as he came, he started to change the directions of society. He started to change the way women were looked at. And this was a great, actually, challenge at that time, which started at the time of the Prophet, and then it started to flourish in the coming generations. So thank you, brother, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another episode. I just bid you farewell. Well, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
According to a recent survey, homelessness in the United States is an all-time high due to rising house prices and a decline in assistance given during the COVID-19 pandemic. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A growing number of Americans are ending up homeless as soaring rents in recent years squeeze their budgets, according to a 25th of January report from Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Roughly 653,000 people reported experiencing homelessness in January of 2023. Up roughly 12% from the same time a year earlier and 48% compared to 2015, Harvard University researchers said that marks the largest single-year increase in the country's unhoused population on record. Homelessness, longer problem in states like California and Washington, has also increased in historically more affordable parts of the United States. Arizona, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas have seen the largest growth in their unsheltered populations due to rising local house prices. That alarming jump in people struggling to keep a roof over their head came amid blistering inflation in 2021 and 2022, and as surging rental prices across the U.S. outpace worker wage gains. Although a range of factors can cause homelessness, high rents and the expiration of pandemic relief last year contributed to the spike in housing insecurity, the researchers found. According to the report, in the first years of the pandemic, renter protections, income support and housing assistance helped stave off a considerable rise in homelessness in the U.S. However, many of these protections ended in 2022, at a time when rents were rising rapidly and increasing numbers of migrants were prohibited from working in the U.S. As a result, the number of people experiencing homelessness jumped by nearly 71,000 in just 1 year. Rent in the United States has steadily climbed since 2001. In analyzing census and real estate data, the Harvard University researchers found that half of all U.S. households across income levels spent between 30% and 50% of their monthly pay on housing in 2022, defining them as cost-burdened. Some 12 million tenants were severely cost-burdened that year, meaning they spent more than half of their monthly pay on rent and utilities, up 14% from pre-pandemic levels. The Joint Center for Housing Studies said people earning between $45,000 and $74,999 per year took the biggest hit from rising rents. On average, 41% of their paycheck went towards rent and utilities. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, tenants should generally allocate no more than 30% of their income towards rent. According to online housing marketplace Rent, although the rental market is showing signs of cooling, the median rent in the United States was $1,964 in December of 2023, up 23% from before the pandemic. By comparison, government data shows inflation-adjusted weekly earnings for the median worker rose 1.7% between 2019 and 2023. The Harvard University report stated, rapidly rising rents combined with wage losses in the early stages of the pandemic have underscored the inadequacy of the existing housing safety net, especially in times of crisis. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. Thousands of volunteers across the United States spent a night in January canvassing their communities to look for people who may be experiencing homelessness as part of the government's annual point-in-time count. The count is required by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and its results can be used alongside other factors to determine funding. But some experts said those estimates have often not been accurate. Hannah Anderson with the Young Women's Church Association, YWCA, a point-in-time count organizer in Snohomish County, Washington, said, "We only have 1 day to get a snapshot of the homeless population. You can't be accurate when you're counting people for just one day. An ABC News analysis found that methods and resources vary from community to community, producing an inconsistent, piecemeal account that even the Department of Housing and Urban Development acknowledges underestimates the number of unhoused people. Eric Tars of the National Homelessness Law Center said, "The picture that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is getting, and that Congress is getting, and that the public is getting, isn't as clear as it could be and should be." The Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge told ABC News in an interview that the count is just a sampling of the country's homelessness crisis. Marcia Fudge said, "It's not an exact science," noting that if methodologies change from year to year, it could cause problems. She added, "There's no other way at this point for us to count all the homeless people, so we just do a sample." Recently, Marcia Fudge announced the Department of Housing and Urban Development's largest funding award of its kind, $3.1 billion to homeless services providers across the country that will fund more than 7,000 projects. The recipients entered Department of Housing and Urban Development's funding competition last year with extensive applications that included their point-in-time count results, among other metrics. Homelessness experts and institutions have been raising concerns about the point-in-time count for many years. Still, guidance surrounding the count has remained largely the same since it was first implemented in the mid-2000s. At least every other year, each community receiving Department of Housing and Urban Development funding must conduct a point-in-time count of homeless population in January, a time when people may crowd into homes with friends or family as much as possible to escape the cold. The Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge told ABC News she doesn't know why the agency requires the count to be conducted in January, but that it will continue this practice for the time being. Fudge added, "It doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense. Because it's cold, it's hard to find people, and people are inside. But that's what has always historically been done, and we just continue to do it the way it's always been done."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.